Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to our learning today. We're on the topic of Assyria's siege of Jerusalem, which is a really remarkably large topic, so we have a lot to cover. But before we start, I want to take a moment to thank David and Irene Foyer, who are sponsoring for the yard site, which was just passed, of Mr. William Foyer, Nachman Zev Ben Shimon, whose yard site we just passed. And actually, David, just a few weeks ago, shared a letter with me that William Foyer fought in World War II and was actually received accolades as an American soldier for his capture and interrogation of Nazi officers. It is a very big zechus to be a Jew on this side involved in saving other Jews, which is Nishmas Eden. We also want to take a moment to thank Shalom and Lori Huberfeld, who are sponsoring for the yard site of Shalom's grandmother, maternal grandmother, Shalom Sarah Bas Yosef, whose yard site is upcoming on the 20th of Av. So the Mitzvah Shem should be Aliyas Neshama for her. Let's start learning together. Let's try to appreciate a very fascinating topic. I'm sure that many of us have had an opportunity of learning some parts of this topic. But it is such a vast topic, and it actually spans three separate Svarim and Nach. So it appears in Melachim Beis, Devar Hayamim Beis, and Yeshayahu Hanavi, and multiple Prakim in all of them. So it's a very large topic. So sometimes what happens is you'll hear fragments of the conversation, but you won't appreciate the fuller perspective of what's happening. We see with the Assyrians, and this is perhaps, it's worthwhile noting, is we see the rise of empires. Imperialism, we have this huge growth of not just what we'll call states fighting against states, but empires that dominate entire areas in the region. So Assyria is one of these which dominates the area for many, many, many years. And it particularly affects Israel during the period of Melachim. And we're going to take a look. I did put in it's a little bit small, but the timeline of Melachim over here. The thing that's worthwhile noting is on the first page, the print is somewhat small just to fit it in, but what is worthwhile noting is that on the right-hand column is the kings of Israel, and you'll notice that the kings of Israel are pretty short-lived. You'll notice on the right-hand side, so you'll see Zechariah ben Yerovam, Shalom ben Yavesh, Menachem ben Gadi, Pekachia ben Ramalyahu, and Hoshea ben Ela in short succession, each line actually representing just about 2 years. So this is a very short succession of Melachim at the end, and that indicates internal strife, right? So that they themselves cannot, and also it represents external strife as well in terms of the kingdom. There's a lack of stability. On the left-hand column is the kings of Judea, and we have Azariah ben Amatziah, Yotam, Achaz and Chizkiyahu. So we see there's more stability in the kings of Judea on the left, and it's interesting to match them up. The kings that are going to be most fascinating for us to focus on now are Chizkiyahu ben Achaz and on his parallel king Hoshea ben Ela, the last king of Israel. So those are going to be the last two kings on that we're going to be focusing on. If you flip the page, just a basic look at the parallel kings in Assyria at the time. The kings that are going to be relevant to us, the ones that Tanakh mentions, are Shalmaneser the third, Shalmaneser the fifth, and Tiglath-Pileser the third, Sargon and Sancheriv. Those are the kings that we're going to be focusing on mainly. You'll notice that there is an important break in the dynasties between Shalmaneser the fifth and Sargon the second. So Shalmaneser over here, although he is the son of Tiglath-Pileser III, when Sargon takes over, he claims to be the king, the brother of Shalmaneser V. It's not clear that he is, and it seems that most historians assume that there was some sort of violent takeover because Shalmaneser is eclipsed, and Sargon rewrites history afterwards. So the history we have is through the words of Sargon II, about how bad Shalmaneser, we'll call it his acclaimed brother, is. It's not clear if he really was a brother. So this is sort of the breakdown that we're looking at. Now let's follow these two frameworks back into the story. So the first time we hear really from the Assyrian side of Israel's relationship with Assyria in a significant way is actually from the times of Shalmaneser III. Okay, so this is way earlier. On page 3, we have in the British Museum, there is something called the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser. And as you can see, it has multiple tiers of picture forms carved into the rock, right? So one of the forms towards the base is this relief, and you can see it over here, where you notice that there is an Assyrian-like gentleman. Now, they all have these very eloquent beards, right? I'm not sure where their hairdressers came from. But they're one of the classic, you know, we'll call it signatures of the Assyrians are their beards. You'll notice there's an individual prostrating himself on the floor, right? He's prostrating himself in front of what appears to be the king, because there's the eagle, the wings over there. And you'll notice on the right hand side are a number of people dressed differently with different head caps on them. Those are Jews. And you'll notice the just sort of the submission. Their bent backs, they're carrying their burdens towards the Assyrians. This is the relief of the Jewish delegation to Shalmaneser III. And the person prostrating himself is a representation of Yehu. Yehu was an earlier king of Israel. In fact, he's a very successful king of Israel. But nonetheless, he's already paying tribute to the Assyrians in the north. What is interesting is that Tanakh does not actually relate this particular incident. Tanakh talks about Yehu not following Hashem and paying homage to Hazael, the king of Aram. Aram is a neighboring kingdom to the north. It is actually south of Ashur, which is Assyria. So it's interesting, Tanakh does not frame this relationship, but nonetheless, it seems that from the Shalmaneser perspective, there already is this level of homage that's being paid. Israel, is to a certain degree, is living in the shadow of the Assyrians. And this is very much true all the way through here afterwards. So more of a famous example of the connection is really a number of years later, in the years of Tiglath-Pileser. So just look at the sort of the timeline. If you reverse to page 2, we're moving from Shalmaneser III to Tiglath-Pileser. There's a number of kings in between, right? And Yehu was much earlier on. By the time we're getting to Achaz, the son of Chizkiah, it's really a number of years later that we have a formal relationship which is created. And we've studied this beforehand. But this is Melachim Beis Perek Tes Zayin. I'm going to skip to Pasuk Hey, in the middle of the paragraph, where at this point in time, Ashur, Assyria, is becoming a dominating power in the Middle East, and the kingdoms to the south tried to band together to fight against them. So we're told in Pasuk Hey to Zion Hey, Oz Yale Retzin Melech Aram Upekach Ben Romaliah Melech Israel Yerushalayim LaMilchama VeYatzuru El Achaz VeLoYochlu LeLochem. Achaz is the king of Judea. He refuses to join the alliance of the northern kings. He refuses to join with his neighbor, his Israeli neighbor in the north, Pekach, and his further neighbor in the further north, Aram, under the guidance of Ritzin. They therefore attack Jerusalem because he's refusing to join the alliance. There's a lot of calibration that goes on, and what happens is that an astonishing occurrence happens. Vayishlach Achaz Malachim el Tiglath Pileser Melech Ashur leimor avdecha ubincha ani. So the king of Judea sends out messengers to Damascus, to Assyria, and he says, "I'm your son and your servant." He says, "Alei v'ashieni mikaf Melech Aram mikaf Melech Yisrael akomim olai. Help me against the Israelites and against the Armenians." Right, so he reaches behind them to the far north to bring in Tiglath-Pileser as the power, and he very happily acquiesces because, of course, there's gold in it for him. And the Tanakh doesn't beat around the bush over here. This is pretty clear what's happening here. Is he empties the coffers of the king in the base of Mikdash and he sends it to Tiglath-Pileser as a bribe, right? We're pretty upfront about how international politics run. Vayishma elav melech Ashur, vayal melech Ashur al Damascus, vayitpasel, vayigla kiro ve'esritzin ha'mis. So he kills Ritzin, the king of Armenia, and he starts the first tour, the military tour into Judea and into Israel, is out upon the invitation of the southern king of Judea. Now, whenever you invite enemy kings in to settle, we'll call it local squabbles, then it's never a good thing. And it turns out that in short order, Ahaz is not able to carry on paying the upkeep and taxes to Tiglath-Pileser, and he himself suffers, because what happens is that the southern states, like Ethiopia and Egypt, look in and see that the coffers are empty, and start attacking in the area of Gaza, but he no longer has any more money to bribe off Tiglath-Pileser. So he's caught in a very precarious situation, as Ahaz is. Now, what is also fascinating, this is a military decision, right? But it turns out that the military is very closely related to the religious setup in society. So Ahaz, at this point in time, while he has the favor of Assyria, where he sends off a delegation up to Damascus, and he sends one of his priests, who goes and he sees what's going on in Damascus, and he asks him to replicate the altar to be found in Damascus, because it's what an amazing culture this is. And he replicates it, and he shifts over the Mizbeach in the Beis HaMikdash, and he makes an Assyrian altar in the Beis HaMikdash. And then he cuts off the bases of the wash basins, the 11 wash basins in the Beis HaMikdash, and sends them off as homage. Bad stuff is going on over here at this point in time. So we'll call it the religious, we'll call it the military decision is, so to speak, very closely connected to the religious decision. The way that they're going to pay homage is whether the decision was made because of trying to find security, or whether the decision was made in order to because he felt at home with his culture. It seems that the enculturalization followed security, which is why so much of Torah is dedicated to not seeking out the peace of one's neighbor. So this is how it begins, and when it begins, it never really ends. And there are multiple tours that Tiglath-Pileser or Pul then take, and they first exile the eastern tribes, and then the northmost tribes. And slowly but surely, we get into the situation where we see in Melachim Beis, Perek Yud Ches, where we're told in Source 2, Ha'ibishnas ha-revi'is le-melech Yizkiyahu yeshanar ha-shevi'is lo-hasheh ben Ela melech Yisrael ola shalom nesar melech ha-shul ha-shomron v'yotzor elea v'yul kadua v'yiksei shalosh shonim b'shnas sheish le-chizkiyahu shnas teish lo-hasheh ben melech Yisrael nilkada ha-shomron. So we hear about the destruction of the northern kingdom. Thank you so much. We're about the northern kingdom of Shomron, which occurs at this point in time. They're not able to pay the taxes anymore. It doesn't help their kinsmanship with the north. And Shomron, which is the northern territory, is conquered by the Assyrians, this time under Shalmaneser. This is not the same Shalmaneser we saw before. This is Shalmaneser the Fifth, who now comes and he conquers Shomron. Samaria is the capital city of Israel. It is now conquered and destroyed. Why does this happen? Tanakh gives us a reason. And Tanakh says in Pasuk Yud Beis, Al Asher Lo Shamu B'Kol Hashem Elokeihem. Because they didn't listen to God. And this is a very important point to realize, is that we sitting here in our deck chairs, sipping our coffees, looking back on history with all our, we'll call it ever-present 2020 hindsight, have all kinds of reasons as to why this happens. Tanakh is trying to frame this in the real reason why it happens, and that is that besides all the military perspectives that we can add, the geopolitics of the Middle East, it was because that they didn't listen. And in fact, if you remember, we studied a few weeks ago around the times of Pesach Sheni, that Chizkiyahu HaMelech actually made a huge Pesach festival. He invited the people of the north to come, and most of them said no, thank you. It was within 6 years of those people who were already as Assyrian subjects. Okay, so just part of this is seen, we have to see it, we'll call it in the religious backdrop as well. So right now, the final exile, if you take a look on page 4, just put in the map, there are multiple tours of the Assyrians against the Middle East. And you'll see that there's the deportation of Tiglath-Pileser, then Shalmaneser the Fifth and Sargon, and there's multiple tours in which Israel were exiled. Okay, so it started off with the invitation of Ahaz bringing in the Assyrians to the east and the north, but it didn't end there, and it carried on going to the point that there is no longer Israel, and there is no longer East Bank, North Bank. It's now just really, essentially, just your Judea as a small southern province.
Just a technical history question. Is there a direct connection between Ahaz inviting Asher in and that first exile that takes place?
Yes, 100%. The first exile of Israel of Reuven and Gad is a direct extension of Achaz's invitation. So yeah, so it's Jew against Jew, right? So this is the model. I mentioned this on Tisha B'Av. This particular model is a very sad model which repeats itself numerous times in Jewish history. Is that as Yeshayahu himself, who lives at this time, says, "Mehorasayich u'machrivayich me'mayich yetzayu," that your worst enemies come from you. Right, and we'll see another example of that in just a moment. Okay, so that leads us to the point where now we meet Sancheriv. Sancheriv is the son of Sargon. He is the king of Assyria. And now his campaigns lead him to Judea. What is interesting about this is that, remember the we'll call the parallel between military and cultural subservience to Assyria. So Achaz really essentially, you know, swallowed a hook, line, and sinker, right? So he was emptying the coffers to Damascus, and he was rebuilding their Mizbeach in the Beis Hamikdash, right? Comes along Chizkiyahu Melech, and he actually changes policy on both of those. He stops paying taxes, and he destroys all of the edifices of his father. In fact, the Mishnah famously tells us that when his father died, as opposed to this grand, we'll call it regal funeral, he takes his father's bones out on a bed of ropes. Most disgraceful description of, you know, of what it was. And that was, we'll call it a symbolic change in policy at this point in time, where he's saying, I'm not doing the same things. And he destroys all the places of service of his father, of what Achaz does. And that being the case, you can imagine the Mizbeach of Assyria has been destroyed by Chizkiyahu. They're no longer, you know, we'll call it having religious delegations between the two. And it doesn't take long for Assyria to say, okay, we're coming in to sort settle this upstart Chizkiyahu Melech. So now Chizkiyahu is going to now suffer for the religious and we'll call it political upheaval that is created in the Middle East. That's what we're now dealing with. Comes along our next step in source 3. I'm trying to just sort of frame it in all the different details, because if we don't look at all the details together, it's harder to get a sense of perspective of what's happening here. Source 3, Melachim Beis Yudches. Uva Arba Esrei Shana LeMelech Chizkiyahu, the 14th year. So this is already 8 years after the exile or the Northern Kingdom. Ola Sancheriv Melech Ashur Al Kol Orei Yehuda B'tzuros Vayitpasein. So Sancheriv now comes and he lays siege to all the fortified cities of Judea, and he captures them. Vayishlach Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda Al Melech Ashur Lachisha Leimor Chatosi Shuv me'alai es asher titein alai ese, v'yose melech Ashur al Chizkiyahu melech Yehuda shlosh me'os kikar kesu shloshim kikar zahav. So Chizkiyahu sends messengers to Lachish, and he says to the king of Assyria, to Sancheriv, I'll pay whatever it is that you want. So it sounds like Chizkiyahu is broken, right? It sounds like he's now repentant. Whatever you want, I'll pay. And they levy against him an incredibly large tax. 300 talents of silver, 30 talents of gold. It's a very large tax. And that's what happens. He empties the coffers to pay this. Doesn't say if he even managed to, you know, get to that amount. He even cuts off the doors, the ornate doors of the Beis Hamikdash, to send them to Sancheriv. Oh, well, that happened earlier. No, it sounds earlier in that there was lots that had happened already. In the Reformation period, which was earlier, when he revamped the Beis Hamikdash, was the first thing he did. Okay, so yes. But this is astonishing. What fascinated me, and I did a little bit of homework on this, is why is it that he's sending the messengers to Lachish? Now, Lachish is a Judean city. It's not an Assyrian city. Right, so why is he sending them there? And the answer is if you follow the history, read a little bit about Lachish. Lachish actually is a very significant battle that occurs. So if you take a look at the bottom of page 4, there's Lachish is actually a very large city that was made on top of a mountaintop, a hilltop. This is a sort of an aerial view of it. On all sides, it's fortified, right? So there's an artist's relief or picture of Lachish. It was a two-walled city. So it had a wall halfway down the slopes and a wall directly around the city. It was an almost impenetrable city that belonged to Judea. If you take a look at the map on the top of page 5, you can see where Lachish is. Lachish is towards the coastal plain of Philistia, or Philistina, which is where the Philistines historically lived. And it's in towards the beginning of the mountains of Judea. So this tour, by the way, just to understand how the Assyrians entered it, in this particular case, they did not choose to go through the Galilee, through the mountains. They choose to go along the coastal plain, which was much easier access. And they started the incursion was from the area of Lachish. Lachish is one of the fortified boundary cities. This is, in fact, a description and an article I found on the siege of Lachish to get a sense of how this siege works, because we have a lot of documentation on this, because the Syrians wrote on this quite extensively and had many reliefs on this because it was such a success. Once the Syrians arrived at Lachish, they realized it was the most vulnerable near the huge gates. Elsewhere, the approaches were naturally fortified by steep canyons, but to the southwest, a saddle connected the city with a hillock. The Assyrians gathered large stones to build massive ramp to reach the saddle of the upper wall. The ramp's base was 230 feet wide, and its surface was stabilized by mortar to allow the Assyrians to drag up five large four-wheeled siege machines with battering rams to break down the main city wall. Meanwhile, the defenders built a counter ramp behind the wall that topped it up by 10 feet. The fighting on the top of the ramp and the wall was intense, as evidenced by a huge number of slingshot stones and arrowheads archaeologists found in the ruins. The Judeans attempted to burn the siege engines by flinging torches upon them, but special Assyrian firefighting troops put out the blazes with water poured from long ladles. The defenders also tried unsuccessfully to smash the siege machines with up to 400-pound stones that they hung from ropes and swung against them. Eventually, the Judean defenses collapsed and the Assyrians broke into Lachish. The base reliefs from the Sancheriv's palace depict the defenders and their leaders suffering hideous tortures as the population is marched out of the city into exile. Yet the cost was high for the Syrians as well. Nearby grave contained the remains of 1,500 of their dead. Sancheriv burned Lachish in a fire that was so intense it was left a 3-foot layer of charred debris. You see, by the way, just on the bottom of here is, in the British Museum, is the Siege of Lachish. This is a relief which is panel by panel describes the history of this particular battle, and in that little section there on the top by the writing, you can just get a sense that those are the Assyrians impaling on poles the Judean leaders. Okay, so when they won, it was a very brutal win. So and if you take a look on the top of the next page, part of that relief put into paper form, it's a little easier to see. You can see actually the wall. You can see the walls of the city. You can see the ramp they made for their siege machines on the right as they bring up their siege machines to the water to the city. And there's obviously many different, we'll call it arrows or ballista, which are being shot in both directions in the siege. It's a very, very significant watermark moment. And that's when Tanakh refers to the fact that Chizkiyahu HaMelech is sending a delegation to Lachish. The reason is because it is ostensibly following this battle that Chizkiyahu HaMelech decides to relent, it seems, at least at this point in time. And he says, I'll pay whatever it is you want. And he agrees and he empties the coffers as following this battle. Right? And Lachish, as you notice in the map, is not so far from Jerusalem. Okay? Lachish is at the base of the mountains. Jerusalem is further into the mountains. But it is likely to say that if they succeeded in winning the Battle of Lachish, Jerusalem will in short order fall as well. Okay, so it sounds like at this point in time, he's now at least, we'll call it politically, subdued himself to the nation of, to the empire of Assyria, to Sancheriv.
And he's surrounded.
What was that?
And he's surrounded.
Well, not yet. He's not surrounded yet. Remember, Sancheriv at this point in time is on the east bank is Assyria. On the southwest is Assyria. So at this point in time, he feels very vulnerable. He pays off this tax. And now he returns to Jerusalem. So what does he do in the middle? What would you do if you were coming back to Jerusalem at this point in time, knowing what's just happened in your kingdom in the southwest? So it's interesting. For this, we switch to Divrei Hayamim base. Okay, so just in order to understand the story, we need to have all the different pieces together.
These drawings here and the wall.
Yes.
I guess it would be the Syrians that did this.
Correct. This is the Syrians. Whoever the victor is writes the history. Yeah. Correct. That's on that. That's on the base. Actually, on Sancheriv's throne is where this relief is found. Okay. So it's so we can see he's very proud of this victory. We'll see he's not so proud of the next part. So that's why it's omitted. So we get to write that part of history. So but let's carry on in just a moment to see what's happening. This is just fascinating to piece the different pieces together to understand what's going on. So now Hizkiyahu returns to Jerusalem. He's paid off Assyria, at least at this point in time. So he's bought a little bit of time. Now he comes back to Yerushalayim. Divrei Hayamim Beis, Perek Lamed Beis, tells us the following. Acharei ha'devarim ha'eleh, ha'evai emes ha'eleh. After these matters and this truth, That's a very important phrase we have to try to come back to in a moment. He wants to capture the cities of Judea. He knows that Chizkiyahu's face is towards Jerusalem, so he knows that it's only a matter of time before he's going to face the Syrian troops. So the first thing he does is he consults with his cabinet, and he says that it's a good idea to block up the springs outside the city. So he says, why is it that we're going to allow the enemies to have our water? After all, where are the springs of Jerusalem? They're in the Kidron Valley, right? There's the Silwan, the Gihon, the Me'a Shiloach, right? These are all found around. There's a number of smaller springs outside Jerusalem. So famously, as we know, there's Chizkiyahu's tunnel, right? So it was there before, but channeling the water into the city and blocking up access on the outside so that when the impending siege will happen, they are not going to have access to the water. Notice, by the way, this is a democratic decision. Chizkiyahu asks those around him as part of the help. He builds the broken wall because of the multiple battles. Remember, Achaz, his father, had to fight against the kings of Ritzin and Pekach, and there was multiple destructions on the wall of Jerusalem. And he fixes up the city of David. The Miloi is sort of this area, which is a historic wall, which was originally the Jebusite wall. He gathers everybody to the entrance, this large meeting place by the Shar HaMayim, by the water gate, and he speaks to them as follows. So at this point in time, you'd say, well, he's going to talk about being strong and military, but listen to his words. Don't be afraid of the king of Assyria and his people. He says, they have lots of people, we have Hashem, we're going to win. It's an amazing thing, just the framework, you know. It's very nice to talk about bitachon and emunah, you know, when the skies are clear. But now, when they're receiving reports from their cousins who used to live in Lachish, right? And you can imagine what people are saying about all the neighboring villages which have been already fallen. You can imagine people are not feeling so confident and comfortable. So Chizkiyahu gathers them together and says, be strong, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to protect us. That's a remarkable statement. We're going to see one of Chizkiyahu's hallmark characteristics is bitachon, is trust in Hashem. So this is what he says. He takes a few steps. In fact, the Medrash, we all famously know the Medrash at the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, where it says that Yaakov Avinu did three things, right? He prayed, he split the camps, and he sent a Doron. The Midrash continues to say the same thing with Chizkiyahu. He makes military preparations, he builds the walls, he recruits the officers, right? He sends he pays off Sanacherib, and he prays to Hashem. So he has all three of those components are also being put together here in his anticipation of this war. But now, the fascinating thing is, why is Sanacherib coming now? So Mepharshim try to debate this. This is not a military question. This is a theological question. Why is this? Surely Chizkiyahu HaMelech is a towering figure of greatness. So why should this even happen? So this is seen as a theological problem. If Chizkiyahu is as great as he is, which is what the Gemara tells us, based on the Psukim, that Chizkiyahu HaMelech trained all the people in Judea, there was no child in the land who did not know the halachas of Taharos. The schooling system, the spiritual level of the society was such. So why did it happen? Why did this even happen? So where the Mitzvah says that the reason is it wasn't a function of Chizkiyahu, it was a function of the people. Meaning, Chizkiyahu was a great king. The people were still trailing behind. They weren't quite there yet. Similar kind of, we'll call it, framework we're going to see later on for Yoshiyahu HaMelech, his great-grandson. Okay, it's going to be this similar idea. The Malvi says, no. You know why? It was, in fact, he was 100% great, and the people were great, and they didn't deserve this. Why did this actually happen? He says, the Malbim in Source 8, the third line in, by the period, he says, Rak Zeyo Bashkacha, this was providence, Shiase Nes Al Yedei Shipul Sanicherev Al Haret Zion. Hashem is doing this for the ends. The ends are going to justify the means, which is that this is going to be a Nes. that needs to be displayed, and in order to do that, he's going to bring Sancheriv to Jerusalem. Okay, that doesn't explain the losses of the other cities, but it does explain, certainly, this is going to be, so to speak, motivated towards the end, is the way that the Malbim misunderstands happening. Yeah, we'll get that in a second.
Oh.
But yes, he certainly is according to the Gemara in Sanhedrin. So, but we'll see why and why not. Perhaps if we have a moment. So a lot of things to say. Now, how did the Sanhedrin look upon Chizkiyahu as he's making these preparations? So we see some degree of ambivalence. The Mishnah at the end of the fourth parak of Pesachim tells us something which makes one's eyebrows raise somewhat. Because think about this for a second. What could he have done? The Mishnah Brachos that appears in Pesachim as well. So the Mishnah says, this is Pesachim, not Brachos. Shisha Dvarim asked Chizkiyahu Melech, Al Shloisha Hoidulov, Al Shloisha Loi Hoidulov. Three things the rabbis at the time, right, the Sanhedrin, approved of, and three things they didn't approve of. Geirer Atzmois Aviv Al Mitzvah Shel Chavonim. He brought his father's bed out in the funeral on a bed of ropes. Very disrespectful. That was approved because his father was so evil. This was a necessary public display to show that this was not appropriate. He removed any oracles which would perhaps lead to idol worship. So one was the Nachash Nachash, which Moshe made, that was the banner, the copper banner, the snake which people were worshipping. He also removed the Sefer HaRefuas, which allowed people to be healed, because he felt that people were relying on that more than they were relying on Hashem, so he destroyed that. Interestingly enough, he got sick later on, right? So maybe it would have helped him, but it didn't, right? So it's important because he davened. Fascinating. And then the three things I didn't agree with is Kitzes Dalso Shalhecho Vishirgon Melech Ashur. It was seen as not favorable that he even sent the doors of the Heichal, which we saw in the Pesukim a moment ago, to Ashur. Loi Hoidulo Sosom Me Gichona Elyon. The fact that he blocked up the springs of Gichon was seen as non-favorable. Loi Hoidulo Iber Nisan Benisan Loidulo. We discussed that a few months ago. The fact that he changed the month, he added a month while the month had already started, while it was the last critical day in Adar, he added a month to the year in order to make sure the festival in Jerusalem was going to be as big as it could have been. But that's not our topic for right now. What's interesting is there's a critique on the fact that he blocks up the spring. Why is there a critique? So the Yachin of Boaz, Rav Lifshitz, Rav Yisrael Lifshitz, in his commentary to Tiferes Yisrael, says, because the Navi Yeshayahu, who was his leader and contemporary, had said in that Jerusalem won't fall. So if Jerusalem's not going to fall, you don't need to do anything. It's very hard. The people are still asking the king. But nonetheless, there was a certain degree of Chizkiyahu's particular midah, which he excelled in, was bitachon, in trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Well, if you trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then it means to say all the way. So this was even seen as somewhat of a compromise. Just fascinating in terms of that. It is interesting, it's worthwhile noting the Chida in his commentary on Tanakh does point out that there's another version of this Mishnah in the Avos Rebbe Nosson, where it actually places this as one of the things they agree with, which could indicate that already even among the world called the rabbinic world, there was an ambivalence to his strategies as well. We see that Chizkiyahu is going to straddle trying to placate the people and also doing what's right in the eyes of God, which is a very difficult balance. And this is perhaps speaking to this in this regard. Now, in enters a new individual. So now, apparently, the siege is on. Sancheriv comes to Jerusalem. The Mefarshim say either because Chizkiyahu HaMelech did not pay the taxes fully or could not carry on paying them. Whatever it was, it seems that Chizkiyahu HaMelech was buying time by paying as much as he could while he fortified Jerusalem. Didn't work. They now arrived at Jerusalem, and they send a delegation to the walls of Yerushalayim. So this is how the negotiations begin. Who's their lead negotiator? Well, I don't know if you call this negotiator, but we'll call it their lead threatener. It wasn't as if they were asking for anything. So here's it. It's an interesting individual. We see in source 14, this is worthwhile noting. Now, we're now shifted into our third Sefer. We've looked at Melachim, we looked at Divrei Hayamim, we're now looking at the parallel version in Sefer Yeshayahu, because Yeshayahu lives at the same time. Remember, Yeshayahu is writing the religious history. He's not writing, we'll call it, the point by point, blow by blow. But this is parallel in all the Sfarim. He says the following, source 14. He captures the Judean cities. So one of his generals, or a military strategist, whose name is Rav Shakei, is sent from Lachish, as we looked at that battle, into Jerusalem. Vayamod batzalaas abrecha elyanah b'mesilas stei koveis. So he stands on this upper ground. Vayetzei elov Eliakim ben Chilkiah asher al abayis v'shevna sofer v'yoach ben asaf hamazkir. So a Judean delegation is sent out to speak to him. What are the terms? What is it that you want? And here's what happens. Vayame, listen to this. Now, he gives three speeches, but the first of the speeches is so religiously endowed. It's such an amazing, this man seems to know a lot. We'll see why in a second. Vayomer alehim Rav Shakeh, imrunu al Chizkiel. So saith to Chizkiel, komara melech ha-gadol, melech ha-shur, ma bitochon azer shabatachta. What is it that you rely on? What bitachon do you really have? Amarti, ach devar svasai meitza gvura la milchama ato al mi batachta kibirad zibi. Who are you relying on that you forfeited your relationship with me? Hinei botachta al mishenes akoneh ratzutz azel mitzrayim asher yisomech ish alav uvol kapoyu nekavah. You're relying on Egypt? So there's an indication that Chizkiah Melech was building ties with Egypt, which is not seen as a good thing. Most of the prophets do not see making ties with Egypt as a good thing. So he's already criticizing this, which, by the way, is a legitimate criticism. Right? Any other king who made an alliance or friendship with Egypt is criticized for it. So he's finding those hairline fractures. He says, how can you have bitachon? We're going to Egypt. You call that bitachon? Right? He says, Ubekein para melech misraim lo kolabot chimolov. He's going to say, no, we're relying only on God. He says, Halo, who asher hasir chizkiyob es bamasov es mizbechosov, ayomel yudav yushalayim lifne mizbechazet tishachavu. He got rid of your bombers. What an unbelievable argument. What is a bomber? A bomber is an altar to God, right? But it's a personal altar to God, right? We set up a tent, the heat is during the winter, it's our own place. We've got to serve God, right? So it was not seen as a good thing. The Torah says don't use them. So none of the kings managed to do it until Chizkiah Melech came and he got rid of them. He destroyed them. So says Rav Shakeh, look, he's taking away your houses of worship. Ah, oh, what a religiously corrupt argument. But it sounds so vroom. Right? He's not allowing you to daven to God. That's what he's saying. It's an amazing thing. Right? So he's saying, it's now. It's better for you to serve my king. I'll give you 2,000 horses. You won't even have enough people to ride on them. You're going to Egypt, they have nothing. Look at their stables. You know what? Hashem said we should come. And it's brilliant. Because if you read Sefer Yeshayahu, he says that. When Yeshayahu spoke to the northern kingdom pre their exile, he said that Hashem's staff of affliction is going to be Ashur. So what's he saying? I was reading your books. And in the book it says, I am your staff of destruction. Right? Shevet Apoy. So I'm going to come. And now listen to me and just submit. Right? What is this? Such corrupt arguments. Right? He definitely knows what's going on, which leads the Chazal to say that Rav Shakeh, in fact, was what's called Yisrael Mumar. He was, in fact, originally an Israelite, a Judean, and he turned coats. He no longer was on their side. In fact, it's just fascinating to notice that Gemara in Brachos Dav Yudam Abayis has an interesting additional text which is to be found in the Bach. Rav Yol Circus has a footnote in the Gemara over there, which most people don't get to. And has an entire passage over there that when you remember Chizkiyahu got sick, we're not focusing on that, that's the later prakim. When he gets sick and he marries the daughter of Yeshayahu to children and they have children. The reason why he didn't want to have children because he was worried about the children. We know that his child, in fact, was evil. That was Menashe. There is an extra additional text in the Gemara that he had two children. And the second child was Rav Shakeh. Now, whether that means to say that the timeline is going to be somewhat difficult because that means his sickness needed to be much earlier and Tanakh places later. But let's go with that. Let's remove the timeline issue. And let's say he got sick early on and this was his own child. Sometimes, again, the statement of Yeshayahu Anavi, Marasayichu Machrivayich Mimeichi Yetzeyu, sometimes is even the worse. If this was a family member as well, who knew intimately the goings on, you can understand the corruption of this speech. You can understand how terrible this speech is, and why he knows so much to be able to make this kind of this complicated speech. But he goes on; it isn't finished. So what happens is, Vayomer El Yakim v'Shevna for Yoach and El Shakei. So he say to him, "Listen, Rav Shakei, we understand this is an important negotiation under the tent there outside by the ramparts of the city, of the wall." He says, "Dabone al dachar Aramis." He says, "Let's switch to Armenia." Right? Right? Why would they say that? Why would they ask that? Because the people are busy listening over the walls, right? And he doesn't want them to hear this. It's so bad. They don't want them to hear this. He says, I'm not speaking to you. I'm not talking to you at all. I'm talking to the people behind you on the wall who are going to soon be drinking their own urine because of the siege we're about to place on Jerusalem. Wow. Listen, this man knows what this is terrible, right? We're going to starve you out. That's why I'm speaking to you. I'm trying to help you, he says. He says, Vayamod Rav Shakei Vayikra Bakol Gadol Yehudis. He calls out in Yehudis. What does that mean? Hebrew. Right? He calls out in Hebrew. Vayomer Shimu Estivrei HaMelech HaGadol Melech Ashur. Listen to the great king of Ashur. Oma Ko Amar HaMelech Al Yasi Lachem Chizkiyahu Ki Lo Yuchal Latzil Eschem Vayivtach Eschem Chizkiyahu El Hashem Hatzel Leimor Hatzel Yatzilein Hashem Ki Lo Esin Osona Ira Zoyz Bayad Melech Ashur Al Tishmu El Chizkiyahu. He says to the people. Like a social media campaign, right? We're not going to, you know, curate this discussion. I'm going to speak directly to the people. I'm going to give them half the information, right? Folks, jump over the wall right now. Join me, because you're going to all be dead if you listen to your king. And then the third speech, he goes on to say, it's going to be tough if you stay in the city. So you know what you should do? Come out. Join me. Everything will be wonderful. You'll all get your own properties. We'll give you tax breaks. Right, we'll make sure that you have everything you need. I'll bring you to another land which is just like yours. Eretz Dagon v'Sirosh, Eretz Lechem u'Kramim, a land which has got all kinds of natural resources. Pen Yassis Eschem Chizkiyahu Lemor Hashem Yitzchelani Tziluah Elokei Agoyim Ishas Artzoy Miyad Melech Ashur. So Chizkiyahu tells you he's going to save you. He said that worked. Look around. Read the annals of history. Read about all the other folks who tried to start up with me. Has any of their kings saved them from Assyria? Nope. So therefore, why are you playing this game with me? That's what I said. Now, he's changed tunes here, right? This is not a religious argument. This is a, we'll call it, economic argument. And it's a very successful argument, if you think about it. Now, the point he fails to mention, what's the fine print here? Res not here, exactly. So he talks about bringing them to a land of Zavaschad Devash. He's probably talking about northern Iraq, right? So the campaign, the way that Assyria worked, was they realized that nationalism is a terrifying enemy to deal with. And as long as you have people remaining on their land, they're going to fight for their land. So what do? You take people away from their land, they now become foreigners in another land, they won't fight for their land. So that's what they did. But he's like, you know, the way he's framing it is like, you know, look at this beautiful secondhand car, you know, you're going to have like Geffen and Taina and all this wonderful stuff. He doesn't mention that they're going to be walking in chains to the area to get there. But nonetheless, that's the arguments. These are three very, very disturbing speeches. What's the response of Israel? So there's a number of responses, but the one that we're told is, and this is often a very important response to people like this. We all have people like this in our lives to some degree. So Chizkiyahu says, don't engage. You can't engage with such people. You're not going to write a response op-ed to this kind of guy. He's going to twist everything you say. Right? It's not worth that kind of thing. He says, and they report and they tear their garments. They know this is a very compromised point in time over here. Very, very difficult. There's a psychological warfare that's over here. The theological warfare that's going on is something which is quite something to behold. We're not going to have so much time to do all the text. I just want to perhaps close a little bit with the following. So what happens is Chizkiyahu turns to Yeshayahu and he asks Yeshayahu to daven for him to Hashem. He realizes he's in a jeopardized situation. And by the way, not only is it jeopardized militarily, but also socially, because he realizes that people are listening, and it's only a matter of time before Rav Shakei's words are going to resonate more and more. And the people on the ramparts are going to start saying, wait a second. Yes?
Haven't Rav Shakei, I mean, I'm saying, why didn't they call
Yeah, I don't know the protocols of, we'll call it, delegations, and you know, and what happens if you kill the person who's Zuzu, right? So I don't know, but they didn't kill the messenger, but he was obviously a very successful messenger, and they're worried that the people have heard this. So Chizkiyahu has a very short time frame now as well as to do what he's going to do. So as opposed to military investment, he now turns to Hashem, and he turns to through the Yeshayahu Melech, and he says in source 20, top of page 9. Pasuk Dalet, he says, Ula Yishma Hashem Elokecho es Divrei Rav Shakei Asher Shlachoi Melech Ashur Adonov Lecharev Elokim Chai Voichiach Badvorim Asher Shema Hashem Elokecho Venosasa Tfila Ba'ad Sheri Sanimsa. So he uses Rav Shakei's words, his speech, and he says like this. He says, it's such a, we'll call it a theological corruption, that such a person should be allowed to stand outside Jerusalem and say such hideous things about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He says, Hashem, listen to this man. Listen to what he's saying. So for your sake, silence him, silence them. That's what Chizkiyahu HaMelech does. Yeshayahu responds, Yeshayahu says to him, if you take a look in source 21, at the end of Pasuk Vav, he says, Ko amar Hashem al tira mipnei advarim asher shamata. Don't fear what you just heard. Hashegidvu na'arei melech Ashuro, I see that the children of Assyria are cursing me. That's a term of disgrace. Hinenino sein boy ruach I'm going to send him back to his land. He'll fall on his own sword. Right, that's what Yeshayahu does. And Chizkiyahu then prays to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, source 22 in Yeshayahu. Again, you can find pieces of each of these in each of the different Svarim. Vayispanel Chizkiyahu el Hashem leimor, Hashem tzvakos lekei Yisrael yeshuv ukriyim, atohu elokim levadecho, lechol mamlechos haaretz asher asiso, esh shamayim esh haaretz, hatei Hashem oznecho, shema pekach einecho re'e, ushma es kol direi Sancheriv asher shalach lecharev elokim chai. Hear what Sancheriv has done. By the way, it's not about because I'm scared, it's not because we're in danger, it's because you have been insulted. Omnam Hashem Ichrivu Malchei Ashur es kol haaretzos es haaretzon, destroy them and their lands. Noson es Elokeihem bo'esh, Eloheihem bo'esh, ki loy Elohim heimo, their gods are not powers. Ki im maaseh Hashem yedei Adam eitzel even v'yabdum, destroy them, they are the work of man. And if you were in this situation, try to put yourself into hearing the news of Lachish and being able to say this prayer is just incredible, incredible thing. It's nothing about military might, nothing about power, nothing about stability. It's about HaKadosh Baruch Hu's honor. And Yeshayahu turns to him. We're not going to have time to go through this now just because of the sake of time. Yeshayahu gives him two signs that he's going to, that he's going to succeed. One sign is that he's going to eat for 3 years a harvest, which indicates that Sancheriv will not come back. And then then the other one is going to be that that the clock will turn back a certain amount of degrees. The shadow will return 10 degrees from the times of Ahaz, his father. Fascinating, time shifting backwards is one of the signs. And this is what Yeshayahu presents to him. What is interesting is that that's exactly what happened in source 25 in Yeshayahu Perek Lamed Zayin. Vayetze malach Hashem vayake b'machane Ashur 185,000. So 185,000 of his soldiers, that's a very large army, at the time, die overnight around the siege. All of them are corpses. And he's killed by his own children. Sancheriv returns when he's in the process of bowing down. He's killed by his own children. So a lot of questions we need to answer. So like, why did this is it's so dramatic a shift to what was happening? What happened? What were we supposed to learn from this? The Radak tells us in verse 26. Rabbi Seinu Amru Kilel Pesach Hoya. It was the night of Pesach that this all occurred. Va'oid Amru Kilifnei Mapalosay Shel Sancheriv Cholach Chizkiyahu Yom Shlishi LeChol Yohaisav Mapalosay Shel Sancheriv. The convergence of Chizkiyahu's personal sickness was at the same time as the siege. That's what the Chazal tell us. So there were two on the inside and the outside he was fighting. So what he's saying is they weren't just ordinary soldiers, they were also officers. They were being killed. This was the night of Pesach, according to Chazal. So there, you can sort of see the siege of old, the resolution, the exodus of old being renewed in the exodus of new, which is happening over here. Why did his sons kill him? So the Radak tells us, he called Becherev, Ba'agada Sancherev Shal Es Chachamov Kasher Hiko Amalach Machaneu Mazuchus Shel Umazu She'elakehem Nilcham Lohem. So he came back and he said, what is happening? This has never happened to me. Why did I lose this battle? This siege. Amrulai Avram Avim Helais Benai Oila. So they said to him, well, his Abraham, their patriarch, did child sacrifice. So we looked at this last time as well. Omar Afani Ale Shne Bonai Lelohai, Kishishamu Bonav Yiko Becherev, Boychaya Mishtachave. So they weren't prepared to be his sacrificial korban, and they killed him before he had a chance to kill them. So there's no, we'll call it innocence in this entire story. Right, so this is seen as the part of the fall of Sancherib as well. It is interesting from the outside sources. This is talked about widely. This is a very famous battle because it has a lot of traction. In fact, Lord Byron wrote a poem called "The Destruction of Sancherib," and just to now again, this is not very historically accurate, but just to get a sense of the pathos. In the second paragraph, he says, like the leaves of the forest when summer is green, that host with their banners of sunset were seen. Like the leaves of the forest that when autumn hath blown, that host on the morrow lay withered and strown. For the angel addressed spread his wings on the blast, and breathed in the face of the foe as he passed. And the eyes of the sleepers waxed deadly and chill, and their hearts but once heaved, and forever grew still. So just like this is very seen as a very dramatic scene in history upon the walls of Jerusalem. What actually happened is obviously not a matter of conjecture in terms of what actually technically happened. Josephus in Antiquities, when describing this, says in Source 30, he says, now when Sancherib was returning from his Egyptian war to Jerusalem, he found many of his army under Rabshakeh, his general, in danger by a plague. For God had sent a pestilential distemper upon his army, and for the very first night of the siege, 185,000 with their captains and generals were destroyed. So he saw it as some sort of plague, as what happens. Herodotus, in describing that war against the Egyptians, actually describes, interestingly enough, a plague which was brought to multitudes through mice, interestingly enough. It was carried by rodents, which destroyed the army. Now what is interesting about all of this is that Tanakh isn't interested in that narrative, which is very important for us to realize. And I think especially for our times, you know, we like to explain things because it helps us control things when we can explain every detail. So, you know, we all want to know what happened, you know, down in Miami. We want to know exactly what happened and why the building fell, and we want to know what happened in Meron exactly, where was it and who, and what was... I mean, these are all important things to plan for, to protecting the future. We should never have, God forbid, such terrible tragedies. But Tanakh's eyes isn't about necessarily explaining the why, or the, we'll call the technical why. God has many ways to do things. And whatever that particular why is, whatever it is, whether it was a plague, or it was a rodent-borne, an airborne plague, or whatever it was that happened, Tanakh isn't interested in that, in the, we'll call, I would say, the how. It was interested more in the greater why. And the greater why, as the Malbim tries to discuss, as the Mitzvot tries to discuss, was that Chizkiyahu Melech was a person who trusted deeply in God, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to show his nace to them, and he did such in a theological way that this should be a lesson. This was a lesson which lasted for many generations. Unfortunately, it was a nace which actually perhaps put them in the wrong direction afterwards. Because what happens is later on in the Babylonian siege of Jerusalem, what they all do is they think back and they say, well, just like it happened to Chizkiyahu, it's going to happen to us, and it didn't. There was a moment where it seemed to have happened, but it didn't happen. So this is seen actually as a negative tiding. We'll get to that, Mr. Shem, next week when we get to the Babylonians. Another aspect of this, which is also important, as Mr. Engels pointing out beforehand, is that the Gemara in Sanhedrin does tell us that Chizkiyahu had the capacity to be Mashiach, but they didn't sing Shira sufficiently. That he wasn't able to capture this moment, he wasn't able to converge both spiritual and physical and to turn this battle into a moment of, we'll call it, outstanding reflection. In fact, we read later on that in Melachim, that after this, he had a visitor. It was a visitor from the north came to see Chizkiyahu Melech. Who was this? He was the king of a small state that nobody had heard about at that time. And that place was called Babylon. And he said, oh, I heard you had such a military success against our problem, our shared problem, Assyria. Can you show me how you succeeded? And Chizkiel very gladly opened up his storehouses and showed him his military equipment and showed him all the success. And when Chizkiel HaMelech himself perhaps was affected by that victory himself, when that neighbor in the north fast became the most terrifying power in the Middle East as Assyria crumbled in the next few generations. So it's important to say, how do we appreciate this? It's interesting that Sanherib does not write about this episode, naturally. But here's what we do have on the Sanherib prism. A prism actually is it's almost like a cylinder, but as opposed to having circular sides, this one happens to be a hexagon. And it's written in cuneiform form, it's in the British Museum. This is what he writes about his campaign in Judea, in Source 32. He says, "As far as the king of Judea, Chizkiah, who had not submitted to my authority, I besieged and captured 46 of his fortified cities, along with many smaller towns, taken in battle with battering rams. I took as plunder 200,000 people, both small and great, male and female, along with a great number of animals, including horses, mules, donkeys, camels, oxen, and sheep. As for Chizkiah, I shut him up like a caged bird in his royal city of Jerusalem. I constructed a series of fortresses around him, and I did not allow anyone to come out of the city gates. His towns, which I captured, I gave to the kings of Ashdod, Ekron, and Gaza." So from his perspective, it was seen as a military success, meaning I succeeded in subduing all of the Judean province. He doesn't mention what happened in Jerusalem because that was the turning point where Jerusalem was able to succeed and push outwards again. So that's sort of his version of history. This is always like sort of, you know, who's writing the newspaper article, right? So this is his version of the history. What is interesting is that Yeshayahu Anavi responds to this inscription. It's just fascinating. So read the other thing. What is the image that he uses to describe how Chizkiah HaMelech is in Jerusalem? He says what? Like a caged bird, right? He can't do anything. I've captured Lachish. I've captured all these cities. He can't get out. Says Yeshayahu Anavi in Perek Lama Aleph. Ketziporim ofois, ken yogein Hashem tzvakois. Like a bird flying free is how Hashem protects Israel, al Yerushalayim, over Jerusalem. Godnon v'itzil posach v'himlit. Hashem is posach. What does the word posach mean? We usually do translate the word from Pesach as Passover. It's interesting over here, that's not what it means. It actually means he was hovering. Hashem was hovering over the troops of Israel. Remember, Chazals will call it natural connection to Exodus, to Yetzias Mitzrayim, the time of Pesach. Pesach is, according to many of the Mephoshim, is not seen as a term of passing over, but rather ever presence. And this is the battle of Jerusalem. As you can see, we just really touched the top of just all the details. There's a lot more that we need to sink into. The signs of Yeshayahu, the prayer of Chizkiah HaMelech, why HaKadosh Baruch Hu answered particularly now. But this is perhaps one of the most fascinating sieges, one of the most fascinating moments in Jewish history, a turning point, which allows us now hopefully to get to the next and more complex siege, which is the siege of Jerusalem under the Babylonians. Thank you everybody for taking the time. Hope everybody has a wonderful and meaningful day ahead. Rabbi Hanani ben Akasha, Amar Atzak.